Welcome to the Sum of It All Cultivating Mathematical Hearts podcast. I'm Audrey Mendeville, along with my colleague Mark Alcorn from the San Diego County Office of Education. And this season, we're diving into the book Cultivating Mathematical Hearts, Culturally Responsive Mathematics Teaching in Elementary Classrooms by Maria del Rosario Zavala and Julia Maria Aguirre. Transcripts to our podcasts are always available for you in the episode notes on your favorite platform. This week, we're diving into Chapter 3. Knowledges and identities.
Well, Audrey, maybe it's a good place to start for us to just remind our listeners that the culturally responsive mathematics teaching tool that has been introduced by our authors, it has three strands in it. And chapter three, our focus for today is on the first of these three strands, which, as you mentioned, is called knowledges and identities. And the authors have a nice little statement that summarizes this strand. Audrey, I'm going to just read it real quick. And it says, bottom of page 30, the first strand of the culturally responsive mathematics teaching tool is knowledges and identities, because fundamentally being a responsive and sustaining educator means working with various forms of deep knowledge of children, their families, and their communities, and giving opportunities for that knowledge to shine in the classroom. Such a great statement to get things going.
It is. You know, that paragraph continues later on. As teachers, we fundamentally shape what children learn and how children learn. And then it says this, we shape their identities as math learners. Like that, I just pondered for a while. Like the idea that our system creates exactly what it's designed to create. Our system right now creates a large proportion of people who don't think of themselves as math people, who don't have positive math identities. Mm. And where does that happen? It happens in the math classroom. Like that's a yikes moment for me as a math educator. So I really think, you know, as we dive into these like components and dimensions of this strand, it's really important for us to be critical about rethinking and redesigning our system in a way that impacts that outcome, that more students would see themselves with positive math identities and as math people.
Oh, for sure, Audrey. And to that note, on page 31, look at the frame that they use as they start each of these big ideas in that section, Audrey. It's, you know, each of those bullets starts with every child, every child. So, you know, it really reminds me of the work around language that really over the last 5 to 10 years, there seems to have been a concerted effort among many people in education to emphasize that the work that we do is not designed for students who we happen to reach, but the intention is to provide the conditions for success for each and every student. Mm-hmm. So I just think it's a good reminder that our language matters, and we need to keep pushing our language to be more inclusive so that we say every student, we really mean it, and we end up expecting brilliance from each of our students. Well, as I'm looking at page 29, Audrey, as I said before, you know, it might be help our listeners to try to get their head around how these strands and dimensions are organized. So if you're listening and you don't have your book in front of you, picture that you have these three strands in each of the columns, all right? And then you have three dimensions moving down from each of the strands so that you have this grid of nine things that you're looking at here. And today that we're focusing our discussion on the three dimensions of that first strand of knowledges and identities. The first dimension is centering cultural and community funds of knowledge. And Audrey, as you know, each of these dimensions starts with an essential question. And I'll go ahead and read that to kick off our discussion. How does my lesson help students connect mathematics with relevant or authentic issues or situations in their lives? What are you thinking about that, Audrey?
Yeah, I love this connection to their first big idea that you called out just recently. It's one of the bullets that starts with every, and it says every child engages in mathematics at home, in their communities, at schools. Like that's a belief we have to recenter in our profession, that everyone engages in mathematical thinking. This happens at home, across cultures, in community settings, and also at school.
Yeah, Audrey, to that point on page 32, there's just a really nice list of things, and some of them we may not always think about in terms of mathematics, like creating a family work or team schedule, cooking and game playing with family and friends, organizing fundraisers, excuse me, for community centers, and on and on and on. And I just really appreciate how our authors are just giving us some good reminders about things that should be in our front of mind as we think about how our students are engaging in mathematical thinking outside of the school.
Yeah, those are great examples. And then on page 33, they show an example of what might happen inside the classroom by showing two different ways that students might show a division algorithm across cultures. And I just appreciated the nuance of looking at them and realizing what's the same and different about these two, compared to what we see in our own traditional American version of an algorithm. And it reminds me of the very first time I was teaching high school math that I saw a student write a comma instead of a decimal point because that was part of the way they had learned in their culture to show a decimal, like a approximate, a part of a hundredth.
Sure.
And I think there's an option whenever we see things like that to listen and accept or dismiss and insist, right? And I feel like our pattern continues to be sometimes to dismiss and then insist on the quote unquote our way of doing things. And it's something I'm being more cautious of, especially as we read this text together.
Yeah, that's great. And I really appreciated how the authors called out as we think about doing this work, the difference between emergent connections that were superficially based on community settings versus the idea of drawing out on the community funds of knowledge to find tasks where the math is actually embedded in meaningful contexts that are past those kind of superficial emergent connections. And Audrey, this actually reminds me of one of the school sites where I was a teacher. We engaged in a neighborhood walk that I participated in. And it was such a powerful experience of walking through the neighborhood and connecting with the families of my students, like outside of the school building. And it was so impactful to me that I went to another school later on in my career, and I initiated a walk at that school as well. But Audrey, I have to admit, like after reading this chapter, I realize how much more could have happened on those neighborhood walks. It, in many ways, I think it was kind of superficial and more about me getting comfortable with the community I served and my students seeing me in the community. I think that it would have been a greater opportunity if I could have used that as a way to learn about my families in a deeper way and how I could have made so many more connections about the mathematics my families were engaging in as they went about their daily business.
I really appreciate that, Mark. That piece you're talking about, the authors talk about a little bit later about this mirror and lens concept around, and it's used commonly, and they recognize that in multicultural education, that the mirror can be like a way to reflect our own experiences, whereas a lens can be a glimpse into someone else's. And I think more often than not, the authors state that mathematics curricula reflects a dominant white, upper middle class, heteronormative, gender binary, English only, seemingly generic reality. That's a quote from them. A reality that only privileged students may have access to understanding. And I'm thinking about that. How do we use that mirror and lens concept to really re-examine those instances as you're re-examining the walks you were on, and think about in our curriculum as a teacher, what do I need to re-examine? In our lessons, what do I need to critically analyze? And how do we use that to then think about what's missing or what needs to be recentered?
Yeah, for sure. And as the authors go further and really challenge us to think about the type of context that we might try to include more in our mathematics teaching and learning, I really like the great practical advice that is included at the bottom of page 34. Like when we're not sure whose reality to privilege for one particular lesson or activity, they suggest we could ask ourselves, who's in need of connection right now and who has yet to shine? And of course, meaning as we reflect on the students that we serve in our classrooms. And just this idea of committing to mathematizing a variety of experiences from the various families that make up my classroom over the course of the school year, That just really makes sense to me, and I just love it as an idea to implement. I could even see that my flexibility of allowing me to be strategic around certain math topics and saying, oh, wait, this setting would lend itself toward this math topic, and it would allow me to think about who is in need of connection right now of my students and who is yet to shine. I really could see that this would motivate me at the beginning of the school year for me to learn all I can about my families and at the communities and my community so that I could think about like, okay, I have all this resource, this treasure of ideas to use. And then as I go through topics, the rest of the year, it's something that will be ready for me to tap on. And I just think this is in such contrast, Audrey, with one of the just practices that continues, which is this idea of instead of like this assets of these of my families, I'm looking at these data cards that are from previous classrooms where I'm making assumptions around where are my individual students in some sort of like an arbitrary high, medium, a low, like deficit thinking that can kind of be continued instead of the rich assets of our families.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Mark. You're also really diving in a lot of the conversation you're having around some of the strategies for doing this work. And one of the things I love that this chapter helps us understand is kind of the structures that the authors are going to use in thinking through these dimensions. And one of those is that in every section, they're going to give us some strategies for doing the work, some real practical ones. So this time there's three, and you've talked about the first two. You have to get to know your students. They talk about some ideas there and their families. You have to get to know the community, some more ideas there, and you've talked about some of these. And then the third one is and practice mathematizing. What do you think about that one?
Oh, Audrey, it's just such a great suggestion to practice mathematizing. We were out in our own community. The more we do this ourselves, the more we can like sharpen our lens to integrate our students' experiences in their communities.
Yeah, I loved it too. It's one of my favorite things to do. What I thought was interesting is reflecting back on this, the first two things that you were just talking about, the idea of really getting to know your students and their families and getting to know the community were things that were so easy for me early in my career because I didn't have kids. I lived in the neighborhood of the school. I showed up at kids' events, students' events all the time, and I realized that the busier my life got with extracurricular commitments and things, the harder it was for me to find time to connect with my students and their lives. And so I really appreciate just this call back to that and the reminder of small ways to do that. And I really appreciate this. One other thing that the authors offer as a structure for us is they provide a rubric for each dimension. What did you notice when you looked at the rubric on this one?
Yeah, so helpful to have a rubric. And I noticed that in that last 5 point, the idea of looking at how a five might be on the rubric, I love how they included reflection by the students as a key part of the work of how the math they're learning, and I'll quote, helps them understand and empathize what is happening in that context. I think it's so smart and it Audrey, I just think it really takes it up a notch to have students do that reflection after an activity.
Yeah, I agree. I thought it was really thoughtful. And then what usually happens is you read a rubric and you're like, well, now I've got to go find a place to try on the rubric. And the authors offer that next because what they play out next is a bit of a teaching story. And they give you some context and some dialogue and you get to hear about what's going on. And then they ask you to pause and think about what you would score it on the rubric. And I thought this was so helpful because they, number one, it gets you really thinking about where it is in the rubric. And number two, they really acknowledged authentically, and I really appreciated this as someone who has the yeah, but ready to go, is they acknowledged the fact that it would really depend on what happened next, right? Like, here's what we saw so far. And depending if this happened next, it might go here to this score, or if this happened next, it might go there. And I just really appreciated the authenticity of it. If you didn't have a chance to read this example, I loved it because the math that they were engaged in is not neat and pretty worksheet math. It's the real world messy stuff. And so I really loved it. And I love the fact that there was a place to really start here and have some practical suggestions about what to do next.
Oh, for sure. And Audrey, much more to talk about, but because of time, we're gonna move on to our next dimension, dimension number two, which is rehumanizing mathematics. And Audrey, I'll read that essential question that kicks it off is, how does my lesson support creativity, broaden what counts as mathematical knowledge, and affirm positive mathematical identities for all students? Well, Audrey, one of the sections in here just is so important, which is who we see as mathematicians matters. And just some great links and resources to dig in further about like who we see as mathematicians and broadening our students' view of who can be a mathematician.
Yeah, I really appreciated this, Mark. Reminds me so much of our earlier season that we had on the book Bad at Math.
Oh,
There's a
yeah.
whole episode around who is a mathematician, who does math, that talks about many of the same resources. There's some new ones in here that weren't talked about in that book, but there's some other nuances to it. Like, who do we really think? What do we think a mathematician looks and sounds like? And if students don't have access to people who look and sound like them or come from these backgrounds that are rich in their heritages, beyond the white centro, European centered normative, set that have been taught year after year after year,
Right.
they miss out on understanding all the beauty of that's out there to see. So
Oh, for sure. And you know, Audrey, as they go down through page 42, they take it to another level, which is necessary. You know, it's not just about appreciating who has been a mathematician and really broadening the view of that. It's about really calling out that school mathematics has historically played a role in ranking and sorting children, as the authors say, through the use of standardized test scores and curricular tracking. And Dr. Rochelle Gutierrez, of course, as we've talked about before, has written about this idea of gap gazing, of how we gaze at these gaps, these so-called gaps, between student groups. And it's just reinforcing, these stereotypes and, just this dehumanization that is reinforced is just really important to call out, Audrey.
yeah, I think it's worthy of reading this section to think about because this dimension is written in exact response to that dehumanization. And I think it's worthy of thinking about those spaces. I think at first glance, you're like, that's math dehumanizing, really? But you read it and you think about all those pieces. I mean, snatching pencils from kids' hands. I mean, there's
Yeah.
stuff that it's like, oh, someone has
Yeah.
done that, right?
Yeah.
And there's other things that you might look at, you're like, who does that? But at the
Right.
same
Yeah.
time, this is written in response to all of those pieces, and I think it's important to read.
Yeah. And, you know, up to this point, Audrey, we've really been talking about sort of like the behind the curtain stuff that educators need to take care of and so forth. But I really like how the authors took it further and said, like, what role do students play in this work? And they gave this really nice example of these frames that children were using to analyze the story problems in their curriculum. And the two questions that the students were using as their frames were, who does this privilege and who is silenced? Like to ask those questions as kids are reading story problems, just so interesting that this conversation was intentional and was allowed to happen alongside the conversation that the kids were already having about the math content.
Yeah, that was beautiful. I really appreciated that too. So, knowing that we have a lot of work to do
Yeah,
around this, I
right.
am
Yeah.
very grateful for the section that has some strategies that we can use to rehumanize mathematics. Which one of the let's see, they have six of them here. Which one of the
Oh,
six
yes.
stood out to you the most?
Well, what I'll say, Audrey, is the one that jumped at me the most actually was the one that I felt like resonates the most with the work I'm engaged in. Like, listen deeply, the instructional approach number three really resonated me with this idea of like making sure we're breaking the IRE patterns in speech and, you know, ensuring curiosity and that students are going to be the drivers of that making meaning of understanding. That really resonated with me. But you know what I want to mention that I'm just more challenged by, Audrey, is that some of these other ones I'm very aware of and have some knowledge of, I don't feel like they seep often enough explicitly into the work I'm doing with educators. So I really appreciate this nice list of approaches that I can say to myself, I need to be more intentional. And some of them I need to find out more about so that I can make sure that I'm including them better.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. So the one that stood out to me was a different one, was number four. It talked about challenging the binary and stereotypical thinking. And there was lots of language in there that I was like, you know, I was highlighting all over it. But the part that really stood out to me is the last sentence. And it says, supporting children to rewrite mathematics problems or their own stories in ways that account for the complexities of humanity is one way that we can challenge this. And I was at a workshop just last week, and I heard Dr. Bill Zahner speak about some work he's doing with folks, and he talked about how one of the ways that they are learning is effective to support multilingual learners and understanding the complexity of math problems. So, you know, people always say, like, not always, I should, oh, look at my language, Mark, I'm catching myself on the podcast. One of the things I often hear from educators is it's really hard for multilingual learners to make sense of really long math problems that are really wordy and really context, you know, driven or whatever. And one of the things that he is studying is what happens when we support students by having them first write their own math problems. So when they learn to write really good math problems, when they learn what components does a math question or a problem need in order to be a good problem, they are finding that those students are now a lot better at making sense of problems when they go to read them. So it made me just think of this way about, like, when this said support children to rewrite math problems, I'm like, why do we not give kids any time to write their own math problems? Like, we spend a lot of time with kids solving other people's math problems. Why aren't they writing the math problems? Anyways, I'm on a tangent. I'll stop because we have so much to discuss. And this book has, like, this chapter was so rich, Mark, like there was so much here. And I don't want to lose sight of the third dimension. So I'm going to move us along to the third dimension, just so we have time to talk about that one too. And that one was called Honoring Student Thinking and Ideas. Let me let you kick that one off. What did you think?
Oh, Audrey, I'm going to start again with that essential question. These are just so well worded. I have to share this with our listeners if they don't have it in front of them. The essential question for this dimension is, how does my lesson create opportunities to elicit, express, and build on student mathematical thinking in multiple ways? For example, through gesture, pictures, and words. And just as you were just saying, Audrey, the language in this chapter is so rich. For example, if we take a look at the bottom of page 51, this idea of, I'm going to quote from our authors, cultivating a classroom where students are encouraged to share ideas, understand each other, and empathize with each other creates a space for students to see themselves as valuable and understood mathematical people. I don't think I've ever read that phrase before, understood mathematical people. I just love the language there, Audrey. It's just so quotable. I felt like if I'm making slides with quotes, I don't know where I would start or stop. So I just another shout out and say, I hope our listeners are reading this book along with us so they can appreciate this in this short episode. Gosh, we're just scratching the surface, Audrey, of the wisdom offered in this chapter.
Yeah, you're right. We're not doing this chapter justice at all. There's so much in here. We need a couple episodes on it.
True.
I saw with what you just read, Mark, connections to two things. One, to universal design for learning, because this idea of planning with multiple means of representation, like we're thinking already ahead of time, all the different ways students might engage in representing their thinking, how they might express what they're doing, how they might show what they know, how they might represent it afterwards. So that really connected really nicely for me with universal design for learning. And it also connected for me with our revised California framework. And one of the intentions of that framework is the importance of students seeing themselves and others as mathematically capable and competent. And that's really what you just were reading, is this idea of students seeing themselves as mathematically capable and competent. So it's so important. It's so critical. So why doesn't it happen? Like, why doesn't it just happen all the time, right?
Well, probably lots of reasons, but our authors share something very powerful on page 53, and this is their quote. Sometimes children say things that seem, I'm going to underline that word, seem designed to derail us and our lesson goals. Boy, I can think of myself probably at one point in a lesson saying that to myself. And I think it's a common thing that as educators, we talk about, like that kids are purposely, you know, taking us off track. And I just think this is such a powerful and necessary reminder with that underlying seem designed to derail us. As educators, we're quick to assume this. Like, what kind of listening are we really engaged in with our students? And are we trying to funnel things so carefully that we're not really listening to our students, and that and being aware that we could have some unconscious biases toward our students, and we could have some cultural misunderstandings about where our students might be coming from in the thing that they're offering. And just the assumption that all these things could contribute to an assumption that a student is purposely derailing a lesson versus there could be other possibilities. And wow, I could just see that as that alone could be a focus for us as educators to really just try to unpack and be aware of, and not just make snap judgments in that way.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Mark. I think as a secondary educator, most of the time those comments were so off of the math topic that I don't know that that was the same issue. But the line that hit me was on the top of page 52. They say, a classroom in which students are not asked what they will not be able to, a classroom in which students are not asked what they think will not be able to meet this dimension on any level. And I thought about that and I was like, how many secondary math classes are happening in this exact moment, if you're listening during the day, or if you're listening at night, happened today, in which students were not authentically asked to think? Like, I don't think it's a zero number. I think it's a non-zero number. I think, like, there are classes, there are students who went to math class today and they were not asked to think. And if they weren't asked to think, then there's no way we can honor student thinking.
Yeah.
It's not possible. And that just hits me. Like, you have to make the first step to actually engage students in some mathematical thinking. And that's something secondary teachers, we got to do better at that.
Yeah, wow, that's heavy, Audrey. It's like, it's a full stop moment, right? Like,
yeah,
you know, like this is step one. And if we're not even at step one, it's none of the rest of it's going to happen. Wow.
Yeah. So if we're just mimicking, it's a problem.
Yeah.
So now the good news is the authors offer strategies. They offer a teaching example. One other thing, a rubric, lots of stuff in here. One thing we haven't mentioned that they offer is an activity. They offer an activity at the end of each of these dimensions. This one I thought is worth mentioning, because I think it helps us go a little bit further. And I know we're so out of time, so I'm gonna make us fast. They talk about this idea of best buy. Like, if students are asked to identify a best buy, like, of these different scenarios, which of these is the best thing, you know, which one of these is the best to buy. And it might be really easy to, like, as a teacher, assume that the best buy is the cheapest or the lowest ratio of whatever the dollar to amount thing is. But these are context problems, right? And so if we are honoring student thinking, that means we are honoring their knowledge and experience of the world. They might come up with a vastly different answer. And, you know, I know this as an adult, and sometimes we are, you know, as math teachers, like, well, don't actually make sense of this. Just answer the question I want you to answer. But I think we need to invite sense making back into the math class. So I know that when I buy bulk fruit at Costco, it is way cheaper than buying at my grocery store. I know the unit price of a banana at Costco is way cheaper than what I can get at the one that's around the corner from my house. But do you know what? They will go bad before my family has a chance to eat them. And there's no amount of frozen bananas and banana bread that I can make that makes it a cheaper deal. We will end up mulching or composting so many of them. Yeah. And it's that kind of thing that, and that's a silly example. Kids have real examples of this stuff. And instead of inviting that into the conversation, we go, that's not what I'm asking for. Just compute it. Don't make sense of it. And we have to marry the two. We have to say, make sense of it. Yes, please. And bring into your making sense of it and make some context make sense and tell me your story. It's both.
Yeah, that was a great example, Audrey. I just think it's so important to notice and validate those potential differences in cultural values that will show up if we allow them to. The authors even mentioned something that I might just assume is pretty clear cut, like an equal sharing context. It seemed to have such a universal appeal, But it's really good to reconsider even a situation like that, as the authors did, as they have a really nice vignette around that. It's just a good example why it's necessary to rethink each context and realize that we make so many assumptions based on our own perspective.
Yeah, and a great point. The classroom teaching example they give does an excellent job of illuminating this idea. So if you haven't read it and that equal sharing is part of what you teach, I highly recommend spending some time on that one for sure.
Yeah, Audrey, all of this, it really goes back to the idea of honoring student thinking, as our authors mentioned. And you know, they say in one of the lines, Audrey, so-called misconceptions. I like how they just phrase that, so-called misconceptions. It reminds me of the work of Dr. Megan Franke, and she has a great phrase to kind of reclaim the brilliance of our students through the phrase partial understandings. What are the partial understandings our students have versus sort of looking at things from a deficit lens?
Yeah, it's one of my favorite phrases from her. There is just so much in this chapter. We could probably go on for another 30, 45, 90 minutes. We won't, I promise. I just am just going to tell you folks, like, if you haven't read this chapter yet, I highly suggest it. There was so much we couldn't get to in this time, and it's worth it. It's worth the read. It's worth the thinking. It is so well done. Grab it and take a seat, spend some time.
Everything you just said, Audrey, and I'm definitely looking forward to talking about the next strand. Well, thanks for joining us for this episode. In our next episode, we will chat about Chapter 4, Rigor and Support. Until then, best wishes in cultivating joy and justice in the mathematics classroom.